Peter's funeral was the worst day of my life. For a week, I wandered around in a daze, hollowed out, unreal, a ghost. When I went back to work, Pauline Grabowski came by to say how sorry she was about Peter's death, and I got a sweet condolence call from Mudman on death row. As for everybody else at Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle, it was strictly business as usual. Every night after work, I went back to my apartment on 114th Street, two blocks south of Columbia. My roommates had left for the summer, and I lay on my mattress, the only piece of furniture left, and listened to the Yanks lose three in a row on a tiny transistor radio I had had since I was 12. Friday night, I hustled down to Penn Station and caught the last train out. Dana wasn't waiting in Montauk, as I had hoped for the entire three-hour trip out there. Since the track stopped barely 2 miles from my house, I decided to hump it instead of calling home for a ride. I figured the walk would do me good. In 15 minutes, I put the darkened windows of Montauk's three-block downtown behind me and climbed the long, steep hill out of town. The night was full of stars, and the crickets were noisier than the traffic. I wondered what had happened to Dana. I walked by the stone ruin of the Historical Society and the stark white 60s architecture of the town library, where I'd often stopped on my way home from school. Peter and I had covered this stretch at least 1,000 times, and every single crack in the pavement looked familiar. We'd walked it, run it, skateboarded it, and biked it in every extreme of Long Island weather, sometimes with Peter propped precariously on my handlebars. And although we weren't allowed to, we'd often hitchhiked it. On account of all the careless Irish kids who come over every summer to pump gas, change sheets, and bus tables, Montauk is one of the last places left in the country where drivers still routinely pull over for strangers. I walked off 27 onto Ditch Plains Road and made the sweeping turn by the beach parking lot. My father's pickup was in the driveway. I guess Mac wasn't done fleecing the pigeons in his weekly poker game. If I was up when he got back, he'd dump his winnings on the kitchen table and I'd join him in a Rice Krispies nightcap. All the lights were out, so I lifted the sticky garage door as quietly as possible and entered through the kitchen. I grabbed a beer and sat in the cool, pleasant dark. I called Dana, but all I got was the answering machine. What was that all about? I sat in the darkened kitchen and thought of the last time Peter and I were together. 2 weeks before he died, we had dinner at a trendy restaurant on East 2nd Street. We polished off 2 bottles of red wine and had ourselves a gas. Christ, he was such a happy kid. A little crazy, but good-natured. Didn't even bother me when the waitress wrote her phone number on the back of Peter's neck. For some reason, I found myself thinking about my pro bono case, The Office, the Mudman, his life on death row in Texas. What Peter and Mudman had in common was the minuscule regard that the powers that be had for their lives. The government valued Mudman so lightly, they wouldn't bother to make sure they were executing the right man. And Peter's murder was so trifling, it didn't require solving. My thoughts were suddenly shattered by a loud crash directly overhead. What the hell? Someone must have broken in through Peter's window and toppled over his dresser. I grabbed the skillet off the top of the stove and sprinted up the stairs. Chapter 16. The door to Peter's room was shut, but the sound of moaning came from inside. I pushed against the door, met some resistance, then crashed through, stumbling over the outstretched legs of the body on the floor. Even in the dark, I could see that it was my father. He was in trouble. He was sick. Obviously, he'd collapsed and fallen, which had made the loud racket. He twisted violently on his back as if he were fighting someone only he could see. I hooked one arm under his neck and lifted his head off the floor, but like a child having a night terror. He couldn't see me. His eyes were aimed inward at the explosion in his chest. "Dad, you're having a heart attack. I'm calling an ambulance." I ran for the phone. By the time I got back to him, his eyes were even more dilated and the pressure on his chest seemed worse. He couldn't take in a breath. "Hang on," I whispered. "The ambulance is on its way." The color drained from his face and he turned a slick, ghostly gray. Then he stopped breathing and my father's eyes rolled up into his head. I held open his mouth and breathed into it. "Nothing. 1, 2, 3. Nothing. 1, 2, 3. Nothing." Tires screeched in the driveway and there were loud footsteps on the stairs. Then Hank was kneeling beside me. "How long has he been like this?" 3, 4 minutes. Okay, there's a chance. Hank had the portable electrocardiogram with him. It was in a white plastic box about the size of a car battery. He hooked my father up, then threw the toggle that sent electrical current into his chest. Now I was the one who couldn't breathe. I stood over my father, numb and disbelieving. This couldn't be happening. He must have come up to Peter's room to reminisce. Each time Hank threw the switch, my father went into spasm. But the line on the electrocardiogram showed no response. After the third jolt of electricity, Hank looked at me in shock. Jack, he's gone. Part 2. The Murder Investigation. Chapter 17. My father's funeral was held just over 48 hours later at St. Cecilia's. Close to 1,000 year-rounders squeezed into the squat stone chapel or stood just outside it for the Monday service. No one was more surprised by the size and intensity of the outpouring than I. My father was reserved and modest, the opposite of a hail fellow well met. Because of that, I always assumed he'd been unappreciated. That wasn't the case. Monsignor Scanlon recounted how at 10 years of age, John Sanders Mullen left Ireland and traveled alone to New York City, where he found a spot in an overcrowded Hell's Kitchen tenement. Macklin and my grandmother couldn't make it across for another 3 years, and by then my father had dropped out of school and apprenticed himself as a carpenter. Even after his parents arrived, he was the family's only means of support for several years.
A 16-year-old boy working 80-hour weeks. Can you imagine?
Asked the Monsignor. 5 summers later, Jack and his new wife, Catherine Patricia Dempsey, were looking for a Sunday's respite from the asphalt furnace. So they rode the Long Island Railroad as far as it would take them. Stepping off, they found a little fishing village that reminded my father of the one he'd left behind in County Clare.
2 weeks later, said the Monsignor, Jack, full of a young man's love and ambition, pulled up roots for the second time in 8 years and moved out to Montauk for good.
I often wondered why my father showed so little zeal for the Hampton Gold Rush. Now I saw that by the time he arrived at the end of Long Island, he was far more concerned with appreciating what he had than lusting for more.
Since the Mullins arrived in this town, continued Thomas Scanlon, I've had many happy occasions to visit them in the house on Ditch Plains Road that Jack built. Jack Mullen, he said, had all a man could ask for. A lovely home, an even lovelier wife, an honest business, and in young Jack and Peter a pair of handsome sons who were always two of the brightest lights in our village. Peter was the town's most gifted athlete, and Jack was showing the academic promise that would eventually take him to Columbia Law. But then, the Monsignor said, catastrophe blindsided the Mullins. First came the much too early death of Catherine Patricia from cancer, and last week the still unsatisfactorily explained death of Peter Mullen, a blow which unquestionably contributed to Jack Senior's death Friday night. To see the hand of God in any of this is obviously beyond our limited knowledge. I only offer what I know to be true, that this life, however short, and it's almost always too short, is precious beyond measure.
Mac, Dana, and I sat in the front row. Behind the three of us, the room shared a cathartic sob. But Mac and I were dry-eyed that morning, at least. To us, this wasn't divine mystery. It was murder. Whoever had killed Peter was also partly responsible for my father's heart attack, or at least his broken heart. As the Monsignor continued over his parishioner's tears, I felt the grip of my grandfather's hand on my knee. I looked into his ravaged face and bottomless Irish eyes.
There's a couple of mysteries of this precious life, he whispered, that you and I are going to get to the bottom of. Whether God in heaven chooses to throw in with us or not.
I put my own bony Mullen hand on his and squeezed back hard enough for both of us to know that a pact had been made. Somehow, some way, we were going to avenge Peter and my father.
Chapter 18. If I thought it was a neat trick squeezing 1,000 full-bodied mourners into a church built for 200, imagine the human gridlock when the same crowd arrived on our doorstep at 18 Ditch Plains Road. Shaguang ran the bar and Seaside Market did the food, and for 6 hours the entire population of Montauk wended its way through our half-dozen small rooms. I believe that every single person who ever had any contact with my father or brother in the past 20 years walked into our living room, took my hand, and looked into my eyes. Teachers and coaches going back to kindergarten showed up and described Peter's unlimited potential at this sport or that subject, as did the merchants who had kept my father in hardware and bacon sandwiches. The politicians, of course, were out in full force, so were the firemen and cops. Even Volpe and Belknap showed their faces. Despite the way things had panned out for the Mullins in Montauk, it was impossible not to feel enormous affection for its unpretentious residents. People give a shit about their neighbors out there. Nevertheless, after a couple of hours, all the faces ran together. I guess that's what wakes are for, turning grief into a blur. In that way, they're diverting. Dana finally left around 6:30. She's not much of a drinker, so I understood, and I appreciated that she knew I had to be there and drink with my old friends and relatives. My friends were there in full force. After the bulk of the guests left, we gathered in the kitchen. Fenton, Marcy, Molly, Hank, and Sammy, the same crowd that had been there for me that night at the memory. We'd all been working on Peter's case, the situation, or whatever the hell you wanted to call it. Fenton had been lobbying hard with the Suffolk County Medical Examiner, an old girlfriend of his, that Peter's death not be treated like a routine drowning. I talked to contacts at the Daily News and Newsday about possible stories, or at least coming out here to talk to somebody about what had really happened that night. "People are talking," Sammy reported about his A-list clientele. "They're starting to feel some heat at the beach house, too. The Neubauers already canceled a party for the weekend of the 4th, out of respect, no doubt." We all applauded ourselves. A big deal, right? We'd gotten them to cancel a goddamn party. Not all of the news was good. 3 nights ago, Hank had walked into Nicholas Cafe, where he'd been head chef since it reopened, and was fired on the spot. "No reason or explanation," said Hank. The manager handed me my last check and said good luck. For 2 days, I was going nuts. Then a waitress spelled it out for me. "Nichols is owned by Jimmy Travalla, a venture capitalist worth a couple $100 million. Travalla is tight with Neubauer. He's a frequent guest at parties. According to my friend, Neubauer called Jimmy. Jimmy called Antoinette Alois, the manager, and that was that. Hasta la vista. Put down the Chaluba. Go directly to the back of the unemployment line." "It gets scarier," Molly said. "I've been doing some asking around about the party, right? Then, the other night, somebody was following me. It was a black BMW. Tonight, I saw the same car parked outside my house." "That's so weird," Marcy spoke up. "The same cretin was following me. It's creepy."
"Hang on to your privates, boys and girls," said Sammy. "The Empire is starting to strike back."
It was after midnight before the last mourner gave me a final damp hug. Then it was just me and Mac in the brightly lit kitchen. I poured 2 whiskeys. "To Jack and Peter," I said.
"To you and me," said Macklin. "We're all that's left."
Chapter 19. I awoke with a hangover that morning after my father's funeral. Around 11, I decided to go see Dana, partly to apologize for not paying enough attention to her the day of the wake, but mostly because I needed someone to talk to. I knew that her parents were still out of town, otherwise I don't think I could have gone to the house. What can you say about the summer cottage that the Neubauers had already turned down $40 million for? Is it real, or is it Manderley? I could never drive onto the property without thinking about how much Dana loved the house and the 12 acres it sits on. Now, what's not to love? A grand Georgian-style house surrounded by apple orchards, 2 glorious pools, a reflection pool for the mind, a lap pool for the body, a formal rose garden, the English-style garden, a circular drive in front of the house that looked like it was built for vintage cars and vintage cars only. I rode Peter's motorcycle up close to the garage, cut the engine, and parked it in an unobtrusive spot.
Even though I had an open invitation to the house, I suddenly felt weird just being there. I tried to shake off the feeling, but it wouldn't shake. I heard a splash in one of the pools. I could see the North Pool, as the family called it, the lap pool, and suddenly I stopped walking. My stomach clutched. Dana was climbing out of the pool, and she had on a kick-ass suit which I had told her was my personal favorite. Beads of water glistened on her skin in the black lycra of the string bikini. She tiptoed across the ornate hand-painted tiles on the deck to one of the several cream and royal blue striped chaise longue. She smiled as she drank in the warmth of the sun. I couldn't believe my eyes. Propped comfortably on the chaise was none other than Frank Volpe. The sickening thing was that Frank looked none the worse for wear and tear of his very demanding detective's job. He was as relaxed and tanned and toned as Dana was. Dana was still smiling as she went and sat next to him. She lay her water-chilled hands on his stomach and he playfully grabbed her wrists. He pulled her on top of him and she covered his mouth with hers. As they kissed, all I could see was the back of her blonde head and his hands untying the strings of her suit. I wanted to look away, to get the hell out of there, but before I could actually move, the kiss ended. Then Dana looked over Volpe's shoulder, and I was pretty sure she saw me before I skulked off to the beamer and headed back where I belonged. Chapter 20. I drove around for a while, fast, too fast for the winding, crowded side roads of eastern Long Island. I was feeling really bad now. Not for myself. Well, hell yeah, for myself. By the time I got home, it was past 4. The house was still a disaster from the day before. I figured I'd better clean up before Mac had to do it. A note was stuck on the screen door. My heart sank. I grabbed and opened it. The stationery was rose-colored, and I could smell perfume all over it. The note said, IL-8-400. The memory. That was enough. I'd gotten messages like it before. Dana wanted me to meet her at the Memory Motel. She was waiting there now. The letters and numbers were the license plate of her Mercedes SUV. The note, the perfume, it was pure Dana. I shouldn't have gone over to the Memory, but what can I say? I went. Maybe deep down I'm a hopeless sap. Or maybe I'm too romantic for my own good. But Dana was there. What was worse? She knew that I would come. She was so sure of herself. Well, maybe I could change that. I pulled open the passenger side door and leaned inside. The Mercedes still smelled new. It also smelled of her perfume. "Sit down, Jack. We need to talk," she said in the softest voice. A slender, manicured hand patted the seat. "I'm fine where I am," I said. "I'm good." "It's not what it looked like, Jack." I shook my head. "Sure it is, Dana. While I was riding around the past couple of hours, it all came together. I saw you and Volpe talking at my house yesterday. Then you left at around 6:30 or so. Amazingly, so did Volpe. You'll have to fill me in on the rest." Dana somehow managed to look angry at me. "He came to our house this morning, Jack, not last night. Said it was about the investigation, but he brought his bathing suit. That's Frank." "So you invited him to have a swim? One thing led to another?" Dana shook her head. "Jack, you can't believe that I'm interested in Frank Volpe." "Dana," I said, "you were making out with him? It's a fair question." "Hey, Jack, let me tell you something that I learned from my father. Life isn't fair. That's why he always wins. It's how the game is played. And Jack, it is a game." "Dana," she waved me off, and it struck me that I had never really seen this side of her. "Let me finish. I know my timing is dreadful, but I've been thinking about this for weeks. I guess it's why I didn't come and pick you up on Friday night. Jack, I need space. I really need time to be by myself. I'm going to Europe for a couple of months. I've never done that before, the European thing." "Oh yeah, me neither," I said. "Run away from my problems." "Jack, don't make this harder than it already is,"
It is hard for me.
Then the tears started to run down her cheeks. I couldn't believe that all this was happening. It almost seemed too bad to be true.
So, Dana, I finally said, is Volpe going to Europe with you?
I didn't wait for an answer. I slammed her car door and walked away. I guess we had just broken up. Chapter 21. I couldn't sleep that night because I couldn't stop the bad thoughts and images crashing through my head. I finally got up and cleaned the mess from my father's wake. Around 5 in the morning, I went back to bed. On Sunday, I made the hour-and-a-half trip to the BMW dealership in Huntington. I figured Peter got financing directly from the dealer, and I hoped that if I showed up with a bike and told them what had happened, they might offer fair market value. The only salesman in the place was a burly ponytailed guy in his mid-30s, and I watched him as he expertly directed a retired couple to a full-dress silver tourer.
"Bags," said the salesman, introducing himself, once he'd loaded up his prospects with brochures. "Although I don't know what I can possibly do for you, since you already got the prettiest, baddest, and best-engineered form of automotive transportation in the world parked right out front. Believe it or not, I delivered the same sucker to a handsome kid from Montauk not 6 weeks ago. Same midnight blue paint, same custom black Corbin seat."
I explained that it wasn't a coincidence, and Bags extended an arm and squeezed my shoulder.
"That's awful. Listen, man, you'll get a lot more for it by putting an ad in the New York Times and selling it yourself."
"All I'm looking to do is pay off the loan," I told him. Bags' eyes grew wide, and they were large to begin with.
"What loan? You don't owe a dime on that, sweetheart."
At his cluttered desk, he pulled out the paperwork from the sale.
"Here we go. Peter wrote me a check for $1,900 for the 10% deposit," he said, showing me a copy. "He paid the rest in cash."
Although Bags may have felt he was delivering good news, he couldn't tell that I didn't see it that way.
"Listen, if a dude walks in with the money, I'll sell him a motorcycle. I'll even sell one to a Republican if I was having a bad month,"
he guffawed. The check was written on a bank 6 exits up the Long Island Expressway in Ronkonkoma. I knew where it was. When we were kids, my father's truck broke down just outside it, and we spent half the night in a service station there. We loved the name so much, it became family lore. 10 minutes later, I was back in Ronkonkoma for the second time in my life, sitting at the desk of the Bank of New York branch manager Darcy Hammerman. She'd been expecting to hear from me.
"Peter named you as the sole beneficiary, so the balance is yours. I might as well cut you a check now, unless you want to open an account here in Ronkonkoma." "I didn't think so."
She opened a photo album-sized checkbook, and in her careful banker's hand filled one out. She stamped "for deposit only" on the back. Then she carefully ripped the check out of her book and slid it over to me. It was for $187,646. I read the 6 numbers in disbelief. My eyes started to blink. I hadn't felt this bad since, well, yesterday. What in the hell had Peter done?
Chapter 22. I needed a friend to talk to, and I knew where to find one. I even had an appointment. Sammy Giamalva was 9 when he matter-of-factly told my brother that he was gay. By the time he was 11, he knew he wanted to cut hair. Probably because of that precocious self-knowledge, Sammy, despite being one of the smartest kids at East Hampton High, was never much of a student. At 15, he dropped out altogether and started working at Kevin Maples. He spent his first 6 months sweeping up hair, then he got promoted to shampooing. 6 months later, Xavier quit in the middle of an appointment, and Kevin gave Sammy a shot at his chair. The rest, as they say, is Hampton hairdressing history. But Kevin milked him dry, booking him for 10 or 11 heads a day, and after a while Sammy's gratitude was replaced by resentment. 3 months ago he quit and opened Sammy's Soul Kitchen in his house in Sag Harbor. Sammy had been cutting Peter's hair for free on Sundays, and in a weak moment at the funeral offered me the same sweet deal. I made an appointment on the spot, and after driving back from Ronkonkoma, I pulled into his driveway. He greeted me with a big hug, then led me to an Aeron chair facing a huge gilded mirror.
"So, what did you have in mind?"
he asked after my rinse. "At these rates, I'll leave it up to you. Express yourself."
Sammy set to work, falling into an easy four-beat rhythm of snip and move, pause and touch. My hair fell in clumps onto the black and white tiles. I let him work in silence for several minutes before I dropped the question. I'd been dreading the answer the whole ride back.
"Was Peter a drug dealer?"
I was studying Sammy in the mirror. He didn't even look up from my cough in progress.
"Hell no. He bought them."
"Well, how the hell could he end up with a new Beamer and $187,000? Can you explain that?"
Sammy stopped cutting.
"Jack, just let it go. Nothing good will come of this."
"My brother was murdered. I can't let it go. I thought you wanted to help."
Sammy gently massaged the back of my neck. "All right, Jack, here's the truth. Peter was the hardest working boy in show business." He cleared his throat, then spoke softly. He sounded like a father belatedly telling his kid where babies come from.
"One way or another, every last one of us out here earns their keep servicing the rich. That's how it is, Jack."
"Well, Peter serviced them a little more literally than the rest of us."
I was starting to feel a little sick and scared. I almost got up and left in the middle of the haircut. I loved my brother, but I wondered if I'd ever really known him.
"He got paid for sex? Is this what you're telling me?"
Sammy shrugged. "It wasn't like he had an hourly rate, Jack, but he was doing some of the richest women in the very expensive free world and doing them rather well. I thought you knew. I thought that Peter told you everything."
"I think that one of his ladies might have been Dana.
But Jack, that was before you two started going out."
Chapter 23. After I left Sammy's, I stopped at a bar called Wolfie's. It's located in the same beautiful wooded part of East Hampton where Jackson Pollock used to paint and drink and drive into trees. I ordered a black coffee and a beer and sat at the bar thinking about my day and what to do next. I finally plucked a wrinkled scrap of paper out of my wallet and called the number on the back. The crisp voice at the other end of the line belonged to Dr. Jane Davis. I hadn't seen or spoken to her in 10 years. But in high school, we'd become pretty good friends when, to everyone's amazement, this shy national merit scholar hooked up with my fisherman pal, Fenton Gidley. Jane, the class valedictorian, won a full scholarship to SUNY Binghamton, then went on to Harvard Medical School. Through Fenton, I'd learned that she'd spent the next 4 years doing a residency in Los Angeles and running a trauma unit at an inner-city St. Louis hospital before burning out. She was now a pathologist for Huntington Hospital and chief medical examiner to Suffolk County. Jane had another hour in the lab, but she could meet after and gave me directions to her house in Riverhead.
"If you get there first, could you take Iris for a walk?" she asked. "The keys are under the second-to-last flower pot. And don't worry, she's a sweetheart."
I made a point of getting there early, and Iris, a sleek, pale-eyed Weimaraner, was beside herself with gratitude. She may have been the size of a Doberman, but Iris was a lover, not a fighter. When I opened the door, she jumped and yelped and skated around the wooden floor on slippery nails. For the next 15 minutes, she yanked me around the tiny subdivision, peeing on its invisible canine boundaries. That pretty much bonded us for life, and we were sitting contently shoulder to shoulder on the front porch when Jane's blue Volvo pulled in. Inside her kitchen, Jane poured dry cereal for Iris, coffee for me, and a glass of tawny port for herself. In the past decade, her beanpole gawkiness had turned into athletic grace, but she had the same force field of intelligence.
"There's been a little dip in Long Island's output of suspicious deaths lately," said Jane. "So I've had a lot of time to spend with Peter."
She pulled at Iris's translucent ears and looked at me intently.
"So what did you find?" I asked her.
"For one thing," said Jane, "Peter didn't drown."
Chapter 24. Jane reached into a battered leather knapsack and dropped a folder labeled Mullen, Peter, 529. on the table. Then she pulled out a clear plastic sleeve of color slides and held one of them up to the kitchen light. "I got these back on Friday afternoon," she said, squinting. "It's a photograph of cells I scraped off the inside of Peter's lungs. See the shape and the color at the edge?" The picture showed a cluster of small circular cells about the size of a dime and tinted pink. She removed a second set of slides. "These are from the lung tissue of a man who got pulled out of Long Island Sound 5 days before Peter. The cells are nearly twice as large and much darker. That's because the drowning victim struggles to breathe and inhales water into the lungs. Cells like Peter's are what we find in bodies dumped into the ocean after they've stopped breathing." "How did he die then?" "Just what it looks like," she said, carefully tucking the slides back into their sleeves. "He was beaten to death." She reopened the fat manila folder and grabbed a stack of prints. "I know you saw Peter that night on the beach, but the cold water holds down the swelling and limits the discoloration. In these, I have to warn you, he looks a lot worse." She handed me the pictures. Peter's shattered, misshapen face was unrecognizable. It was all I could do not to look away. On the beach, his beauty was largely intact. In these, his skin was an awful yellowish-gray. The bruises made him look like a human punching bag. Jane digged deeper into her pile and fished out the x-rays. They documented the assault in terms of fractured bones. There were dozens. With the tip of her pen, she singled out a clean break at the top of Peter's spine. "This is what killed him," she said. I shook my head in disbelief. The anger building inside me was getting impossible to control. "So what do you have to do to prove someone was murdered? Pull a bullet out of their head?" I asked in disgust. "It's a good question, Jack. I sent my initial report to the East Hampton Police Department and the District Attorney's Office 2 weeks ago, and I haven't heard a thing." I cursed out Frank Volpe all the way back from Jane's. He had the reports on Peter, and he hadn't done a goddamn thing. He was still talking about a drowning, a suicide. How the hell could they cover something like this up? Who was I up against? When I got home that night, Mac was snoring on the living room couch. I slipped off his glasses and shoes, spread a light blanket over him, and tucked him in for the night. I couldn't bear to wake him and tell him what I'd found. Then it hit me. I went into the kitchen and called Bert Kearns, the reporter from the East Hampton Star who'd slipped me his number at my father's wake. 10 minutes later, Kearns stood at the door with a tape recorder and two reporters' notepads. "Christ," I said, "you're faster than Chinese food." Chapter 25. Kearns worked quickly. When I went to the front porch to get the Star, a day later, I saw the shit had really hit the fan. Finally. It was all over the front page. A 36.4 column headline with the same question I'd been asking. How did Peter Mullen die? Beneath it was everything I'd unloaded on Kearns in the kitchen, from the absurdity of Peter or anyone choosing to go swimming that night to the overwhelming and so far ignored evidence of a vicious beating. The story also broadly hinted at the possibility of an affair between Peter and Dana Neubauer. Running throughout the extensive story was a guilty-sounding chorus of no comments, did not return repeated phone calls, and refused to respond from Detective Volpe and the startled representatives of Campion and Barry and Mayflower Enterprises. The power couple were still on the road working to smooth over the Bjorn Boontang takeover, and apparently Peter's death didn't justify a simple change in their itinerary. The aggressive reporting was supported by a righteous editorial calling for an inquiry into Peter's death. The failure of the East Hampton PD to question Barry and Campion Neubauer about a death which took place on their property while the victim was working at their party is ludicrous. It concluded, "This is a disturbing reminder of the often glaring inequities in our criminal justice system." I read the story through once, then I went and got Mac and read it to him. "It's a start," he snorted. For the next week, the story roiled the East End like a summer storm. You couldn't walk into a restaurant or shop without hearing charged suspicions being aired. Of course, Fenton, Marcy, Molly, Hank, Sammy, and I were doing our share to keep Peter's story top of people's minds. What had started as a quest for me was turning into an obsession. The news coverage didn't stop with our local weekly. New York Magazine sent a reporter and a photographer, and two New York TV stations ran nearly identical segments with a trench coat reporter treading the moonlit beach where Peter's body washed ashore. One evening, I received a call from Edward Mahoney, a well-known reporter-novelist who lives on Long Island.
"My editors at Vanity Fair are begging me to do this story," he told me. "But I hate the Hamptons in the summer."
"I do too, but you should do the story anyway. My brother was murdered."
"You're probably right. I'm sorry if I was flip. In the meantime, I just wanted to tell you not to let the bastards get away with it."
He reminded me of Mac. During those weeks at Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle, I also threw myself into the Mudman case. The injustice of his scheduled execution and the cover-up of Peter's murder had become connected in my mind. I prepared a 200-page response to the judge's reaction to our latest request for DNA testing in Texas. The senior associate glowed and said it was the best work he'd ever seen from summer help. No wonder. It was why I had wanted to be a lawyer in the first place. Chapter 26. Fenton Gidley was baiting lines on the deck of his boat when the fixer pulled up alongside in a 20-foot Boston whaler. He cut the engine and called to the burly, sandy-haired fisherman who happened to be Jack Mullen's best friend.
"Hey, Fenton, how are they biting?"
the fixer asked in a snotty, wise-guy voice. Gidley looked up, saw this big guy with a scar on his cheek. He didn't have time for idle chit-chat.
"Do I know you, buddy?"
The fixer pulled out a 9mm Glock and pointed it at Gidley.
"I think you're going to wish that we had never met. Now, I want you to stand up real slowly. Hey, he follows instructions. Good. I like that in a punk loser. Now, jump into the fucking water, Gidley. Jump or I'll shoot you right between the eyes. It would make my morning."
Fenton jumped off his boat, went under briefly, and then bobbed to the surface. He was wearing shorts, a faded Hawaiian shirt, and work boots. He needed to get the boots off.
"Leave the boots on," the fixer said.
He leaned over the edge of the whaler and stared down at Gidley. Then he smiled.
"You're going to die out here today. More precisely, you're going to drown. You want to know why?"
Gidley was obviously smarter than he looked. He was paying close attention, searching for some way out of this. But there was no way out.
"Peter Mullen's murder," he said.
He was already having trouble staying afloat. The water was choppy and cold, and the boots were a bitch.
"Peter Mullen wasn't murdered," the fixer said. "He drowned, just like you're going to drown. I'm going to stay right here until you go under for the last time. That way, you don't have to die alone."
And that's what the fixer did. He kept the gun on Gidley and watched him with only mild interest. He drank a Lipton iced tea out of the bottle. His eyes were cold and flat, like a shark's. Gidley was a strong kid and he really loved life. He didn't go down the first time until almost half an hour after he jumped into the water. The second time was only a few minutes later. When he fought his way back to the surface, he was coughing up seawater and foam, choking on it.
"Peter Mullen drowned," the fixer called to him. "You understand that now? You getting a feeling for drowning?"
Fenton finally started to cry, but he wasn't going to beg this bastard for his life. It wasn't much satisfaction, but it was something. He went down again and immediately took a big gulp of salt water. His chest felt like it was going to explode this time. He pulled off his boots, what the hell, and let them go to the bottom. Then he came up for one last time. He wanted to kill the fucker, but it looked like things were going the opposite way. Fenton couldn't believe what he saw when he struggled to the surface this time. The whaler was pulling away.
"You owe me one, Fenton,"
the bastard shouted over the engine noise.
"You owe me your stupid life."
Fenton got the rest of the message, too.
Peter Mullen had drowned. That was the way it had to be. Fenton floated on his back for a while, until he was strong enough to swim to his boat.
Chapter 27.
The fixer was having a busy and productive day, looking downright mellow in baggy shorts, oversized t-shirt, and his St. Louis Cardinal cap pulled down to his Ray-Bans. He lazily pedaled his rented bicycle down Ditch Plains Road. As he passed number 18, he gave it a long, hard look, then released his grip on the handlebars and rolled serenely by.
"Look, Ma, no hands," he said to the cloudless afternoon sky.
A couple of yards later, he swerved into the packed lots of the East Deck Motel and stood his bike in the motley row lined up at the break in the dunes. Then, with a tube of lotion and the latest Grisham in hand, a big yellow beach towel slung over his shoulder, he backtracked toward the house on Ditch Plains Road, affecting the exaggerated shuffle of a recreating yuppie. Now came the tricky part. Two doors down from the Mullen place, he cut across the lot where a big new house was going up and headed toward Ditch Plains Beach. But then, as if realizing he'd forgotten something, he turned toward the Mullen's rear door. He pulled a flexible ribbon of steel out of his deep-pocketed trousers and probed the lock. When the first two attempts failed to produce the telltale click, he realized the goddamn door wasn't even locked. "That's a sign," he thought, as he let himself inside. "Don't be too creative." For the next half hour, he followed his own advice, scouring the drawers, the cabinets, and the bookshelves. But the obvious places didn't yield what he was looking for. Ditto the clammy crawl space and the tiny attic. He was starting to sweat. The fucking house wasn't air-conditioned. He checked behind every picture on the wall and peered into the sleeves of old Beatles and Kingston Trio LPs. Then he went through the closets, which were jam-packed with Mullen memorabilia. "Where the hell did you hide it, Peter? This is important, you miserable little fuck. People could die, including your musketeer pals, even your hotshot brother. So where the hell is it, you little dead fuck?" After another 30 minutes, he was in such a foul humor, he was sorry to see Mac's old Datsun pull into the driveway. After all, if the old geezer had stumbled on him mid-search, he would have had no choice but to kill him. Maybe he ought to do him anyway. Let the town spill a few more tears for those poor, afflicted Mullen boys. No, no. Spontaneous mayhem was for amateurs. He'd already caused enough trouble for one day. He waited by the deck until he heard the garage door squeaking upward, then slipped out the back and hustled toward the beach. "God damn you, Peter. Where the hell did you hide the salami, pal?"
Chapter 28.
On Wednesday morning, I was tucked inside my tiny office in New York by 8 o'clock. Everything that could possibly go wrong seemed to have. The phone rang, even before I picked up. I muttered, "Uh-oh." It was Fenton, calling from the island. "Hey, man, good to hear your voice," I said.
"Yeah, well, hold that thought," he said.
Then he told me what had happened the day before alongside his boat. By the time he was finished, I wanted to rush back to Montauk, but what the hell good would it do? "You have any ideas who he was?"
"I'd bet anything he's one of the bastards who killed Peter."
After I finished telling Fenton to cool it and to be careful, I sat at my desk and felt like the powerless person I was. Sammy was right. The Empire was striking back, and my friends were feeling the brunt. The bright spot of my day happened between 9:35 and 9:37. Pauline Grabowski, the private investigator, peeked into my office and held up a bag from Krispy Kreme.
"I bought 2 glazed, and I'm only eating one," she said and smiled.
"You sure?" I smiled back.
"Positive."
"You okay?
Gonna save the mud man out in Texas today?"
"I hope so. Thanks for the thought, and the sugar hit."
"Donata, young Jack. It's only a donut."
My best friend had almost drowned, and I was eating a donut and flirting. It wasn't right. But what are you gonna do? Mid-morning, I got a call from William Montrose's executive assistant, Laura Richardson. Montrose, the most senior partner and chairman of the management committee, wanted me upstairs.
I reminded myself that if I was about to be fired, the axe wouldn't be wielded by the mighty Montrose, but by some anonymous hitman in HR. Even so, it didn't take the metallic taste out of my mouth.
Chapter 29.
The elevator opened on the 43rd floor and I crossed the threshold into corporate paradise. The beautiful Laura Richardson was waiting, a tall, regal, African-American woman whose lustrous skin outshone the mahogany-covered walls. She beamed as she led me down a long corridor to Monty's corner office. The whole floor was enveloped in an otherworldly quiet and calm.
"Don't worry. I've never gotten used to it myself," said Montrose, about the panoramic view from his 30-foot wall of glass. He and fellow partners Simon Lafayette sat on matching black leather couches. Behind them stretched Manhattan from the UN Plaza to the Williamsburg Bridge. The iridescent tip of the Chrysler Building burned right at the center. It reminded me of Pauline Grabowski and her amazing tattoo, among other things.
"You know Simon?" said Montrose, nodding in his direction. He didn't ask me to sit.
On one wall were photographs of Montrose's wife and five children. The black and white pictures conveyed the gravitas of official royal portraits. That he had procreated so abundantly was a statement in itself.
"I was just telling Simon what terrific work you've been doing on the Innocence Project. Top drawer all the way. Everyone seems to think you're very special, Jack, not only someone who will be offered a job here, but partner material."
Now his smile vanished, and the silver blue eyes narrowed.
"Jack, I lost my own brother a few years ago, so I have a little idea of what you're going through. But I also need to tell you something you obviously didn't know, or you wouldn't have acted as you have been lately. Barry and Campion Neubauer and their company, Mayflower Enterprises, are very important clients of this firm.
Jack, you're right on the cusp of something special here," Montrose continued, gesturing out toward the metropolis. "Jeopardizing it won't bring your brother or father back. I've been there, Jack.
Think it through. It's all very logical, and I'm sure you understand. Now, I know you're busy, so I appreciate you taking the time to have this little chat."
I stood there, immobile. But as I struggled to come up with exactly the right response, Monty turned his attention to Simon. I found myself staring at the back of his head. Our meeting was over. I'd been dismissed. A few seconds later, the lovely Laura walked me back to the elevator.
Chapter 30. As I waited for the elevator, I hated myself about as much as a 26-year-old can, which is a lot. Finally it arrived, but when the doors reopened on my floor, I couldn't move. I stared down the long corridor that led to my office and imagined the 20-year death march, which, if I was lucky and a big enough scumbag, would lead back up to 43. No one walked by, or they might have called security, or maybe the company nurse. I let the elevator doors close without getting out. They reopened on the marble lobby. With enormous relief, I continued outside onto sunny, sooty Lexington Avenue. For the next 2 hours, I walked the crowded midtown streets, grateful for a place in the anonymous flow. I thought about Peter, my father, and the warning that Fenton had gotten. Then it was Dana and Volpe, the beach house, the evil empire that obviously extended into the offices of Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle. I'm not too strong on conspiracy theories, but there was no denying the connection between a lot of recent events. My walk took me east to a small park overlooking the East River. Technically, I guess, it was the same river that bisected Montrose's view, the one he dangled in front of me like a family heirloom. I liked it better down here. I leaned against a high black railing and wondered what I should do. The sight of the Chrysler Building from Montrose's office had reminded me of Pauline. Since I was just about the only one left in the city without a cell phone, I dropped a quarter at a noisy corner payphone and asked if she'd meet me for lunch. "There's a cute little plaza with a waterfall on 50th Street between 2nd and 3rd, she said,
Pick up whatever you want to eat and meet me there. What do you want, Jack?
I'll tell you over lunch.
I headed there immediately. That meant I got to see Pauline nimbly weaving through the packed sidewalks, her head down and her dark brown ponytail brushing her classic blue suit. Despite everything that had happened that morning, I couldn't help smiling. She didn't so much walk as glide through the crowds. We found an empty bench against the wall, and Pauline unwrapped a chicken sandwich on 12 grain. It was a big sandwich for such a slender woman. She knew it, too. Aren't you going to eat? Is that how you keep so trim? Starvation? I'm not all that hungry, I said. I recounted my visit to the top of the world as she listened and ate. Her eyes expressed sympathy, then outrage, and when I told her about Monty's amazing view of her tattoo, a little mirth. The city is full of women who, with imagination and style, can make a little beauty go a long way. Pauline did her best to downplay hers, but with the light on her face, there was no concealing it, and it took me by surprise. She already knew about Neubauer's relationship to the firm and had done a little inquiring of her own. Personally, I don't like Barry Neubauer. He can charm birds out of trees, but he gives me the creeps. Mayflower has an account with the most expensive escort service in the city, she said. It's not all that unusual for certain corporations. The service is like a co-op, Jack. You need letters of recommendation, there are interviews, and you have to maintain a balance of 50,000. That's all common knowledge. The next part isn't. 2 years ago, one of their A-list escorts drowned when she supposedly fell off a yacht during a moonlight sail with Neubauer and his friends. The body was never found, and Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle handled the matter with such panache it never made the papers. I stared at the cement and winced.
What's the going rate for a dead escort these days? I asked.
$500,000. About the same as a one-bedroom. The girl was 19. I looked into her eyes as she finished off her sandwich and wiped away the crumbs. Pauline, why are you telling me this?
I want you to know what you're getting into, Jack. Do you understand?
That's when it hit me, and I couldn't help what I did.
Pauline, help me on Peter's case, I blurted out. Work on the good side for a change.
It doesn't sound like a wise career move, said Pauline. I'll think it over.
Then she got up and left.
I watched her walk all the way to Third, and then she disappeared into the thick midtown stream of pedestrians.
Chapter 31
What I'm looking for, insisted Rob Kuhn with contagious excitement, is not another lovely, formal English garden, but a full-on maze where you can go in one end and get lost for a few days before finding your way out.
Marcia Burt and her potential goldmine of a landscaping client, sitting in one of the sunny front booths of Estia, sipped their lattes and let the deliciousness of the concept sink in. Kuhn, the 30-year-old scion of the country's first family in parking garages, explained the source of his inspiration.
I rented The Avengers the other night. Except for Uma, it blew, but the maze rocked.
It would be a fabulous project, said Marcy, and flashing dollar signs notwithstanding, she meant it. Ideally, you would design it in such a way that you could keep changing the course so no one would get bored.
Kuhn beamed.
Very cool, he said.
The two fell into an enthusiastic discussion about the hardiest strains of evergreen, landscape libraries, possible models. They were talking about the need for a research junket to Scotland when Kuhn stopped in mid-sentence. Detective Frank Volpe and two other men in dark suits had entered the popular Amagansett restaurant. Kuhn's eyes followed them to their back booth.
You know them? Asked Marcy.
The tall guy with the beard is Irvin Bushkin. A lot of people consider him the best criminal attorney in America. If I ever kill my wife, he's the first person I'll call. I believe the guy to his left is the Long Island District Attorney, Tim McGuire.
Kuhn didn't recognize Volpe, but Marcia did and realized the meeting might have something to do with Peter's death.
Rob, said Marcy, this is the most exciting assignment I've ever been considered for, but I need 30 seconds to make a phone call.
That's when she called me at the office and I called Kearns at the Star,
Less than 5 minutes later, there was a screech of rubber out front, and Kern stood, mic in hand, in front of Volpe's table.
"What brought you to town?"
Kearns asked Irving Bushkin, and although there was no response, continued undeterred.
"Who's your client? Does your visit have anything to do with the investigation into Peter Mullen's death?"
Small and round, with fat, freckled hands, Kearns doesn't look like much, but he has balls. According to Marcy, he peppered them with questions until Volpe threatened to arrest him for harassment. Even then, he pulled out a camera and snapped a quick picture of the famous visitor and his pals. But that wasn't the best part. After Kearns left, Megan, the waitress who'd taken their order, came out and informed them that there'd been a mix-up.
"I'm afraid we're all out of the pasta special," she said.
"It's 10 past noon,
protested Volpe, but the waitress just shrugged. There was considerably more grumbling before the three changed their orders to cheeseburgers and a turkey club. The request was barely in when Megan returned with more bad news.
"We're all out of that, too,"
she said.
"As a matter of fact, we're plumb out of everything."
At that point, Volpe, Irving Bushkin, and District Attorney Tim McGuire stormed out of the restaurant. Half an hour later, Marcy got a handshake deal to build what promised to be the only bona fide English garden maze in the Hamptons. At least for a week.
Chapter 32.
For Mudman's sake, and I suppose because I wasn't quite ready to ditch my whole legal career, I returned to Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle and spent all Friday working on the latest appeal. In the morning, I re-reviewed his court records and was outraged by the minimal effort of his court-appointed attorney. I had lunch with Pauline, and she told me she was still thinking about my offer to work for the good guys. I don't know what else we talked about, but suddenly it was 3 o'clock and we hustled back to the office. Separately. For the remainder of the afternoon, I drafted a response to the judge in Texas. Even though I say so myself, it was persuasive. It was after 11 that night when I emailed a copy to Exley. Even though I felt okay about my day, the moment I got back on Peter's bike and pulled down the visor of his blue Akai helmet, I began rewinding my life like a depressing old video. Soul-searching wasn't a real good idea right now. I couldn't come up with too many selfless or generous acts in my life. Of course, I had no trouble coming up with bad stuff. The most damning incident that came to mind had occurred 7 years before. It was at Vermont when I was a senior. Peter was 14 at the time. It was winter break and he had come up to spend a long weekend with his big brother. One night we borrowed my roommate's car to get some Chinese food. On the way back to the dorm, a local cop pulled us over for a broken taillight. He was being a bastard and he decided to search the car. It occurs to me now that on that particular night the cop was playing the part of the townie and we were the little rich shits. That's why he didn't stop until he was holding up a skinny marijuana cigarette between his fingers. I explained that the car belonged to my roommate and that we had no idea there was pot in it. In fact, that was true, but he ignored me and drove Peter